One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Today on The Grave Talks, spontaneous human combustion. Spontaneous human combustion. It's a haunting phenomenon that has been a mystery to man for centuries. Could spirits of poltergeists be the source behind this unexplained occurrence that's taken the lives of many? Is the spirit world intervening on the living, causing them to end their journey in life before its intended time? Today on The Grave Talks, we talk about the link between spontaneous human combustion and poltergeists. Are we getting closer to an answer on the multiple grisly deaths caused by spontaneous human combustion throughout history? Lewis Proud thinks he may have some answers.
Really, it all sort of started back in, my teenage years. I had quite a few sleep paralysis experiences. And of course, that's a condition where you find yourself paralyzed. Basically, you emerge from sleep, but your body is still asleep, your mind is awake, and you're in that strange kind of liminal state, mm-hmm. Sort of a twilight state of consciousness. And during that state, of course, yes, your body is paralyzed to prevent you from acting out your dreams, because basically you're still in sort of REM sleep.
Sure.
Essentially, that's what the sleep scientists say anyway. But during that state, you can have all sorts of very strange hallucinations, or so-called hallucinations. So basically, from my sort of late teens up until my sort of mid 20s, I had quite a few sleep paralysis experiences. So I wrote a book about that called Dark Intrusions, an investigation into the paranormal nature of sleep paralysis experiences. So that's really how it all started, because I was exploring the overlaps between sleep paralysis and some of the strange things that people experience, and also various paranormal phenomena, including mediumship and of course ufology as well. I looked into alien abduction and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So really, that was my that's how I sort of made my start in this area. And then since then, I've written other books. Of course, there was The Secret Influence of the Moon, there was Strange Electromagnetic Dimensions, and now my fourth book has just been released, or was released in January, which is called Borderland Phenomena.
Yeah, and I want to talk about kind of a bit of all of this, since we're kind of beginning our introduction here and learning about what brought you in, and sleep paralysis being one of those things. Yep. Hosting this show for several years, I've heard thousands of stories of sleep paralysis, some where you can't really pinpoint it down to being anything paranormal other than just the mind doing what it will. Others with yep. very convincing evidence that there's something else involved here beyond just our minds. When you first had that experience, was there anything beyond when you woke up? Was there any evidence, so to speak, in your surroundings that pointed to your experiences being anything that would actually lend itself to more the ghostly paranormal realm, or was it just such a shocking and almost a, you know, it's an experience I've had it once myself in my early 20s, where it's just it kind of rocks you a little bit. You don't know what to make of it, especially when it first happens. What was it like for you?
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, I should point out that, you know, when we use that label sleep paralysis, we're really referring to a whole range of, you know, different experiences, and they can vary in intensity as well.
Sure.
So, you know, a lot of people will experience just the paralysis part. Mm-hmm. And of course, that can be quite scary in itself, you know, because you can't move your body and that kind of freaks you out a little bit. But, other people have more intense experiences, and they also experience the, as I said, the so-called hallucinations as well, which can be very intense. So you can experience all sorts of things. You can experience, for example, the feeling of someone or something touching your body. Mm-hmm. So there's that tactile element. You can also hear voices as well. Sometimes these are like a sort of internal type of voice. Other times it seems very much external.
Sure.
To the person. There can also be weird things too, like this is one reoccurring element is the bed rocking phenomenon, where it feels as though there's something at the end of the bed basically rocking it back and forth, which is quite scary. And this is something too that a lot of people talk about, you know, when they stay in a so-called haunted house or something like that. So there is that crossover between sleep paralysis and things that people experience, you know, in so-called haunted locations, etc. And there does seem to be a geographical element to sleep paralysis as well. So it seems as though in certain locations you're more likely to have these experiences. So the thing about sleep paralysis, the really shocking thing, is the fact that there seems to be a presence there, sometimes more than one presence, that is interacting with the person. You know, and I experienced all sorts of terrifying things, like, you know, at one point it felt as though something was trying to choke me to death. So one feels very much kind of, it almost feels as though you're in the presence of some kind of demonic entity or something like that. So it is very, very terrifying. And sometimes, too, when it's reoccurring, when it keeps happening again and again, night after night, you know, it does really feel as though that there is something out to get you, if you like. And a lot of the things that people talk about in sleep paralysis are also elements that feature in so-called alien abduction experiences as well. So I do feel that there is a genuine paranormal element to sleep paralysis. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily just the person's imagination in every case.
Sure.
I think maybe during that altered state of consciousness, maybe we experience things from other realities, other dimensions, however you want to put it. You know, cause once again, it's got to do with that sort of liminal state of consciousness, that state of being, you know, not awake but not asleep, that sort of twilight state, if you will. And that seems to be where the paranormal sort of manifests. It seems to happen during those kind of liminal states of consciousness.
What was it like? What was it like for you though, when you had the sleep paralysis experiences? Was that something where it was it terrifying for you? Was it a calmer experience? Tell me about your experiences.
Yeah. Well, I really kind of sort of I feel that I suppose I thought I just kind of did, because I was talking about my own experiences.
Oh,
there,
okay,
where
okay.
I felt as though
okay.
I was in, you know, there okay. did seem to be some kind of demonic
presence. I wasn't sure if you were just speaking in general terms of an explanation
okay.
of sleep paralysis or your own personal.
Yeah.
Okay, sure. Okay, so when you were having these experiences, and it sounds like you really ran the gamut. You ran almost, you know, the definition of every
yep.
which way that this could happen, and how it feels, where
yep.
some just have, you know, this aspect of it and that aspect of it. When you walked away from that and you wanted to find out more, what were you expecting? Were you believing off the bat that this is something paranormal that was happening to you? Or were you more so in the mindset of, wow, our mind is pretty powerful. It can do some pretty amazing things.
Right. Well, I mean, initially I didn't know what was going on. I didn't even know that there was a condition called sleep paralysis. So, you know, it was helpful to have that label to assign to the experiences. Although it is just a label, it doesn't really explain anything.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm sure that some of what I experienced was, you know, simply my imagination. But I do feel, too, that there was something else going on. So I just really wanted to explore it and sort of find out what was happening. You know, that's why I investigated it. That's why I wrote the book. You know, so and I mean, it's still a mystery, obviously. We don't really know exactly what is happening. And the thing is, too, that the weird thing is that even though this is related to the REM state, you know, the sleep scientists say, all right, it's just basically you're still in a dreaming state. It does feel as though you're awake, but essentially you're still dreaming. Therefore, the things that you're experiencing are, you know, simply dream images and that kind of thing. But that doesn't really make sense because, you know, with dreams, of course, you experience a whole range of different things. Pretty much anything can happen during a dream. You know, the imagination just runs wild. But with sleep paralysis, people seem to have there's these reoccurring themes, and you know a lot of people talk about seeing like cloaked figures and that kind of thing.
Sure.
Because sometimes you can actually open your eyes, you can actually see your external environment, and you know you'll see these kind of ghostly presences and that kind of thing. I mean, I remember one time I was lying there in bed and I saw this kind of sort of goblin type creature sitting on the bed next to me, and it kind of I looked at it and then it kind of looked at me, and there was this moment of kind of recognition, or you know, it was did seem as though I was very much in the presence of another entity, some other being. So you know, when you have those experiences, it's hard to just say, oh, it was just my mind, it was just my imagination, because they're so incredibly powerful. It feels as though, you know, it's the same as when you've experienced things during the normal waking state.
Sure.
You don't doubt what you experience. You say this is reality. It's the same during sleep paralysis in some cases. It can be so incredibly powerful, you know, so I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah,
but
I mean, what led you to? From what I'm understanding here, you do go down the road of believing there is something more paranormal going on. I don't want to say sinister. I mean, some of the feelings you get almost feel sinister. But there is something that is beyond just our minds that are intervening, if you will, when we are in that state. What did you find in your research, and what have you come to believe on that?
Well, look, I mean, the journey hasn't ended by any means.
Sure. Up to this point.
And these are all sort of, these are all sort of open questions. But up to this point, I suppose really I've come to accept that, you know, that our definition of nature, if you like, reality, is very limited. So I feel that, you know, when we talk about the natural world, you know, that encompasses so many different things. Possibly that also encompasses other realities that are intersecting with ours as well. So I like to think of nature in the form of a circle. And this is how I came to come up with this term borderland phenomena for my latest book. You know, we think of nature as if we think of it in the form of a circle, there are certain things that we understand quite clearly that sit within the middle of that circle. And then, of course, there are things around the border or periphery that we don't quite understand. So, you know, borderland phenomena, which is really synonymous with, you know, paranormal phenomena. That's really what I'm referring to.
Sure.
But, you know, there's good evidence now that we do inhabit a multiverse, that there are, in fact, other dimensions, realities, you know, that may, in fact, interact with our own. So, and I feel, too, that maybe, you know, what's necessary in order to experience things from those other dimensions or realities is you do need to be tuning into a different kind of frequency, or you need to be in an altered state of consciousness. And of course, we find that during the sleep paralysis state.
Mm-hmm.
We're really referring to what's called, you know, the hypnagogic, hypnopompic state. Hypnagogia, of course, is that's when you're basically when you're falling asleep. Hypnopompic, that's when you're emerging from sleep. But they're essentially the same state of consciousness. But, the, you know, entire books have been written about, you know, hypnagogia, the hypnagogic state. And some people can actually train themselves to enter that altered state of consciousness. Basically, you sort of allow your mind to relax. and you can, you know, apparently some people can stay in that altered state of consciousness for prolonged periods of time and, you know, basically just experience all these very strange things. And it's also the state of consciousness that you need to be in if you want to have so-called out-of-body experiences as well. You're probably familiar with that book. Sure. By Robert Munro, of course, wrote about this. And he was essentially describing that same state of consciousness. And apparently he was able to have these out-of-body experiences at will. So it seems to be very much a gateway to all those strange experiences, lucid dreaming, out-of-body experiences, et cetera, et cetera. It all seems to hinge on that sort of hypnagogic, hypnopompic state. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, with the new book, Borderlands, obviously you talk about quite a bit in there. One of the areas that, you know, honestly, I haven't covered a whole lot in all the years of doing this program, but is one that has always intrigued me. And I think it intrigues me back to childhood and probably watching. It stems back to episodes of Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack. Mm. And that would be the spontaneous human combustion. It's something that has always been it kind of borders on ghostly. It goes into medical science. It goes into many different areas. And you just kind of go, what is going on here? And that's something that you certainly talk about in the book a bit. Let's discuss spontaneous human combustion. And for those who are not familiar, what exactly, how would you define it?
Yeah, okay. So basically it's an unexplained phenomenon whereby the human body is almost entirely reduced to ash. Generally occurs within a sort of 10 to 12 hour period, although it's hard to put a time frame on it. And basically what happens is, as I said, the person is almost entirely reduced to ash, and that includes their flesh and bones. Generally there's part of the body remains unburned, and that usually is like one or two limbs, etc. It seems to affect the trunk of the body primarily, so there may be a foot or a leg, etc., remaining unburned. And it's such a strange thing because, you know, it is very, very difficult to reduce a human body to that state. Mm-hmm. Because if we look at what happens in a modern crematorium, we're talking about very, very high temperatures that are needed to vaporize and oxidize the body. We're talking about, you know, temperatures of around 1,150 degrees Celsius, or between 760 to 1,150 degrees Celsius. And it takes around 90 minutes to 2 hours to reduce the body to that state. And even then, the bones are usually remain, and of course they need to be crushed up using a machine called a cremulator, which is basically like a large blender that just sort of pulverizes the bones. And we find that in cases of SHC, the bones have already been reduced to that fine powder. So it's very, very strange. So the mystery really is, where does the energy come from? And, you know, by what process is that achieved? So that's really what SHC is in a nutshell.
Now, forgive me for my ignorance on the topic. It's something I've never really researched in that great of depth. Is this something that is recognized by the medical community as something that happens factually? Is it one of those things where somebody goes, well, somebody physically burned this body. We just don't know how they did it. Or how is it recognized, medically when the rare cases where people do find bodies in this state?
Yeah, well, I mean, the evidence is undeniable. So, you know, scientists, medical professionals, etc., they recognize that it's a real phenomenon. But basically, they believe that it's, it doesn't happen spontaneously.
Okay.
So in their opinion, there's really nothing that would enable such a thing to happen spontaneously. So they do accept that these unusual deaths occur, But they believe that it's due to some kind of external means. So, for example, it would be due to a ember from a fire or a spark or you know, perhaps having your clothing get in contact with the, you know, something like the flame from a gas stove or something like that. So they believe that, you know, these things do happen, but it's basically the person, you know, somehow catches on fire from some sort of external means. And they rely on a theory called the wick effect, which basically likens the human body to a candle, but an inside-out candle. So the clothing represents the wick, and the fat of the body is basically the fuel or wax. Mm-hmm. So they believe that what happens in these cases is that the person, you know, catches themselves on fire. It starts to burn their clothing. Then it starts to melt the fat in their body, and then basically it starts to draw out the fat as a wick would do, and then the body is slowly reduced to ash in that manner. So they've done all sorts of experiments as well. They did a whole bunch of experiments with pig carcasses. Basically, they wrapped the pig carcasses in blankets. They had to use a accelerant such as petrol to try and get the fire going. They've done all sorts of experiments, but really the results that were obtained from those experiments were very underwhelming, because we certainly did not see the same amount or the same extent of burning as we find in cases of SHC or supposed SHC. So they've tried to replicate those effects, but they haven't been successful in doing so. So if you look at, you know, scientific articles and that, well, articles by skeptics on SHC, basically they do say that, yes, okay, this exists, but it's not a spontaneous process, and it can be explained via the wick effect. So that's what they say, but the evidence, as I said, doesn't really rather indicates that something much more mysterious is happening.
Sure. Doesn't support it very, very much in terms of what people are finding when it actually occurs. In the book, you talk about a case, Mary Reeser. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mary Hardy Reeser, she was a 67-year-old widow. She lived in Florida. Previously, she lived in Columbia in Pennsylvania. But basically, she was living in Florida. She moved there to be closer to her family. She had a son there. She really hated the heat and humidity. I should also point out this case occurred back in 1951. It's pretty much one of the most famous case of SHC, and probably the most widely publicized and so on. It did generate a lot of attention at the time, and there were many, many articles in newspapers, etc. But basically, she'd been living in Florida in an apartment, and it was just for a very short period of time. I think she'd only been there like 5 weeks in that apartment. And on the night of July the 1st or 2nd, that's when she died. Basically, her landlady went to deliver a telegram that morning, and she touched the metal door handle, and it was hot to the touch. And then she smelt smoke, etc. And they went into the apartment. She didn't enter the actual landlady, but the police officers and firefighters and so on went in to investigate. But basically, almost her entire body had been reduced to ash. There were just a few parts of her body that remained unburned, and that was just her. There was basically a chunk of backbone, part of her left foot, which was still clad in its slipper. What else was there? There was also a purportedly shrunken skull was remaining as well. So pretty much her entire body had been reduced to ash, along with the chair on which she'd been seated as well. She had been seated in a chair that night. Her son had actually seen her that evening, and she'd been seated in that chair. And so there you have it. So it was very, very strange. Basically there was, as we find in cases of SHC, even though the person has been reduced to that state, the surroundings are pretty much unaffected. And we found in this case, for example, that there was paint on nearby walls that was neither cracked nor singed. There was a pile of newspapers just to, like, was an arm's length of where her easy chair had stood that weren't even scorched. There were also sheets on a daybed just a few feet away that were completely unmarked. The ceilings and walls were smoke blackened. It was just incredible that the apartment itself didn't, you know, sort of go up in flames. So that's a very, very strange thing about SHC, is that the fires are incredibly local, localized. Mm-hmm. Just affects the person, and maybe, you know, if they're seated on a chair, the chair will also be reduced to ash, but surrounding objects are pretty much unaffected. So it was very, very odd. And also there was a anthropologist named Dr. Wilton Krogman, who went in to investigate. Basically, he had been vacationing near St. Petersburg at the time, and he was called on to have a look into the case because he was an expert on what happens to the human body when it's reduced to ash. And he was completely baffled by this case. There's a great quote here. Of course, he said he'd never heard of anything like it, but there's this great quote that I just wanted to read out. He said, "I've been present at tests of body and bone reaction to extreme heat, and it's been established that heat of about 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is around 1,650 degrees Celsius, is necessary to completely consume the bones, as happened in the Risa case. I cannot conceive of such complete cremation without more burning of the apartment itself." So that's the very key thing here, the fact that the fires are so localized, the fact that surrounding objects were more or less unaffected. So there you have it. That's, as I said, really the most famous case of SHC of all time, the Mary Hardy Risa case.
Do you believe there's anything in the realm of paranormal, meaning ghost? I mean, obviously, this, the whole thing is paranormal, so it's a wide term, but ghostly, yeah. I should say, that or other dimensions, something else that's interfering here or playing a role in this phenomena with people, or could it be something completely internal with the individual? That they have going on or initiating themselves.
Yeah, right. Well, I think it's very much related to poltergeistry.
Okay.
And really that's the because basically my book Borderland Phenomena deals with three key areas. The first one is spontaneous human combustion. The second one is poltergeistry. And the third one is anomalous lights. But so there's a theory that that basically SHC is sort of the very much connected to poltergeistry, because in the case of poltergeistry, we always find that there's one individual around whom the paranormal activity occurs. So that person is called the agent or focus. And the leading theory is that it's due to the psychokinetic effects that occur due to this person's subconscious. So their subconscious is causing those effects, and it's because they have all this sort of pent up anger and frustration, and it's basically a way for them to externalize all that anger and frustration. That's the leading theory for poltergeistry, and it's called the recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. That's what it's called, RSPK for short. So there's a theory, and this is a theory was developed partly by Vincent Gaddis. I think he was one of the first people to come up with this theory, or at least to discuss it in detail. He wrote a famous book called a great book called Mysterious Fires and Lights, and he did talk about the Mary Hardy Risa case as well. But he was basically saying that in the case of poltergeistry, the energy is externalized. And in the case of SHC, the energy is internalized, and it's used to essentially end that person's life. So he called it a form of subconscious suicide. And we find that, of course, in SHC, generally most victims are elderly, and they're usually depressed individuals who are quite isolated socially. Mary Hardy Risa was quite depressed in the weeks leading up to her death. So that's really the theory is that it's caused by, as I said, it's a form of subconscious suicide, whereby that energy is internalized, And it results in the person literally bursting into flames and obviously dying in a very dramatic fashion. I think that's really the strongest theory. And I think it's got to do too with the body's electrical system. Because all of the activity in the body, of course, is electrochemical in nature. We have, of course, nerve impulses, etc. So all of our thoughts, all of our actions, etc., are characterized by some form of, electrochemical activity. So possibly what's occurring is that there is some kind of malfunction within the body's electrical system caused by those negative suicidal thoughts that then result in, as I said, that malfunction results in the body literally bursting into flames, because it's, you know, you've got to think, where does the energy actually come from? Mm-hmm. And that would be a very sort of logical explanation as to where that energy comes from, considering that we are, you know, electrochemical or electromagnetic beings. So I think that's really the strongest theory. Of course, it doesn't really explain what's happening. It just sort of points in a certain direction. But I think it is very much tied up with poltergeistry. I don't know if there is any kind of external cause. I mean, that there have been various theories that have been proposed that basically suggest that there could be some kind of geographical element in that, it's got to do with ley lines and that kind of thing. So currents of energy in the earth and where those currents intersect, it could have something to do with that. Larry Arnold wrote a great book on SHC, and he explores all of those various theories. But as I said, in my case, I tend to sort of lean towards the subconscious suicide theory. I think it's the most logical. But again, there could be all sorts of different factors involved. And there's so many different theories. Some people say it's related to black magic. It's related to Tummo, Kundalini energy. Could be some form of hypothermia, which I don't think is really very logical. Subconscious suicide, I think that's probably the strongest theory, in my opinion, anyway.
When we're talking about poltergeistry and that phenomena, there's a lot of views or assumptions as to what it would be. I guess probably one of the more traditional is that it is a ghost in its most generic sense, meaning it is the spirit of a dead human being that is coming back, that is causing things to move around. But is poltergeistry more so something that is caused by the living versus the dead?
Yeah, well, I did talk just a moment ago about, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. And really that is the leading theory, because we always find that at the center of the activity there is a person, and generally that person is quite troubled. Generally it's a teenager as well, someone who's undergoing puberty, who is quite frustrated, angry, etc. So it does really seem to be very much related to that person's psychology. The subconscious, of course, is able to, we as human beings have all these remarkable abilities that we're sort of more or less unaware of, which can manifest at certain times under certain special conditions. So really, and rather than say that, okay, it's due to spirits, it's due to demons or discarnate entities, etc., really it's, the simplest explanation is that it's due to that person's subconscious mind, that it's got to do with the mainly untapped abilities of the human psyche, if you like. That seems to be the most logical explanation, but at the same time, there are some poltergeist cases that do seem to point towards maybe some kind of external factor as well. Maybe some other sort of entity, etc., is involved. I know that Colin Wilson and Guy Lyon Playfair, they were British authors. They actually subscribe to the spirit theory, and Colin Wilson wrote a lot about poltergeist. He basically believed that, well, initially he thought that it was related to the subconscious mind, but then he saw evidence that indicated, in his view, that it was due to some kind of discarnate entity, maybe some kind of vampiric entity that was attaching itself to that person and then drawing on that person's energy and using that energy to create these sort of psychokinetic effects, you know, which involve such things as objects being thrown around, you know, rapping noises on walls and that kind of thing. All those, you know, sort of typical poltergeist type effects.
Sure.
So that was the theory that he subscribed to. As I said, I lean more towards the subconscious explanation. But you know, once again, it's sort of, we haven't really come any closer to explaining, you know, what's occurring. It's and the thing is too, parapsychologists don't really deal with poltergeist cases anymore either. You know, so it's not really something that gets investigated in that much detail, and that there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in poltergeist type effects. You know, parapsychologists today, of course, are more interested in such things as, you know, studying micro PK and that sort of thing. I don't know if you've read books by Dean Radden. You know, he doesn't really deal with poltergeists at all. It's something that they don't want to touch because it's, I suppose, because it's so controversial. And also it's, I don't know, maybe they find it a little bit embarrassing to even discuss those sorts of things.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Lewis Proud about spontaneous human combustion. In part two of our interview, according to spirit theory, poltergeists are exactly that, the spirits of the deceased. What is Lewis's take on this theory? Are poltergeists able to spark spontaneous human combustion? Is there any hard evidence to support the theory that ball lightning could be responsible for at least some incidents of spontaneous human combustion? And what are some of the most mysterious cases of SHC that have been documented throughout history? We'll discuss all that and more with Lewis Proud in part two of our interview on spontaneous human combustion here on The Grave Talks. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Sign up to become one at patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month gets you access to part two of this interview and every interview we've ever done. To get it all, go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. You'll also get access to advanced episodes of our program months before they're released to the public. And you'll be supporting this program and keeping it on the air at the same time. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.